Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Crew Call with Mike Rose. This is the September Crew Call, episode 2-9. And my guest tonight is Justin Jankoskis. How you doing, Justin?
I'm doing great, Mike. How are you?
I'm pretty good for an old dude. I think I might have a couple years on you. But Justin has a very fine railroad based on the D&H Penn Division, and I got to see a lot of pictures about his railroad on Facebook, which seems to be a good sharing medium these days. And the more I saw the pictures he was posting, the more I thought, geez, this guy is a highly compatible modeler. So I thought it might be good for us to have our usual conversation about what he's doing, why he's doing it, how he's doing it, and just kind of share some techniques here. So welcome aboard, Justin. How did you end up picking this particular prototype?
Well, the D&H, I grew up along what was the Penn Division. I was born and raised in Carbondale, Pennsylvania. And at one point, Carbondale was a major hub along the line for the D&H there. It was basically the heart of all of the anthracite production, not only for the D&H, but also for the Erie, that was jointly owned that line.
How far is Carbondale from Taylor?
It's probably about 30 miles or so.
Okay.
Yep, just up the valley, up the Lackawanna River.
My understanding is that Taylor was sort of created to be sort of a marshaling yard for all the little sub coal yards all over the place.
Yeah, there were sub coal yards basically all the way up the valley because the entire valley was dotted with breakers. Some, big mass production breakers. Others were just, small little rinky-dink operations. But the railroads, especially the D&H, they tried to get service to, every last usable piece of coal that was in the valley. So, that was a major. That was the major commodity, all the way back to the Gravity Railroad and the canal system over in Honesdale. I mean, that was the infancy of the anthracite production, but it all stemmed from that.
So the era that you were living there was like approximately what, during the 70s maybe?
It was late 70s, early 80s. The Penn Division, I mean, I was young, but the Penn Division, it was the tail end of the operations, really. They still serviced the area after they shut the line down. I think it was like the mid-80s when they really started to abandon the line north of Carbondale.
Right. They came in from the south, right?
Correct. Yep.
Yep. That's kind of how DLW does it now, right?
That's exactly how they do it now. Yeah, they come in because everything is intact basically to the it's the Lindy fracking operation. They have a big sand operation up there, a transload. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the major customers on the DL right now is moving that frack sand up there. And that facility, that transload, is located in the old yard in Carbondale that was the D&H yard. There was a 41 stall roundhouse there. I believe the footprint of it's still there. The roundhouse is gone. The smokestack is actually a cell phone tower. They left the smokestack and it's a cell phone tower.
One rugged cell phone tower.
Yeah.
That's interesting. So did you see the transition off of the Penn Division over to the former Erie tracks?
I recall every once in a while you would see a D&H locomotive working the, there was a, plastics plant just south of town that still received a good number of carloads of pellets in the 80s. But most everything had already been transitioned to, out of Taylor up straight into Binghamton by the time I was. But, in the area there was always, you could find D&H stuff anywhere, really.
So your modeling era is specifically what, like very early 80s?
I kind of backdated even before that. So my era is like 77-ish, and I don't pinpoint it down to, you know, a specific date, but that late 70s, you know, 77 to 79. And the reason I backdated it is just because, well, obviously, the, you know, the pin division was still in existence, but it was just the variety of motive power and just the unique things that could be seen on that stretch of track. And it was a very unique stretch of track in that you needed pushers both ways to get trained up and over the mountains from both Landsboro to the summit and from Carbondale to the summit. So, I mean, there was a lot of interesting railroading going on that stretch of track.
And when did that actually start to tail off?
It was early 80s, probably 82 maybe or so, when they really started routing most everything over the newly purchased line.
Gotcha.
So, yeah, it was just servicing local customers up until probably the mid-80s when they completely embargoed the line. And then that's when they sold it to the county and, you know, the Lackawanna Valley was formed, which operated the line before DL came in.
I know a little bit about backdating, so I completely get that, you know. And if you're a prototype modeler, really one of the first things you need to decide is approximately when am I modeling? Now, I mean, I certainly get, you know, when I first started real prototype modeling, I chose the early 90s Conrail, you know, mm-hmm. And that gave me a little bit of leeway and fudge factor. The reason I decided to pick a particular year is that in the early 80s, and I'm modeling 1984, there were some specific things that happened immediately after that that made a big difference. So I had to sneak back into 84 in order to get to where I wanted to be in terms of the consignees and the traffic and even really the paint schemes, you know. So mm-hmm. like in my era, I'm able to see all kinds of foreign power because of the Guilford takeover, but I think I only have one Guilford engine, you know what I mean? So right. it enables me to still maintain that D&H flavor, but still see plenty of Maine Central and Boston Maine power, which was a huge attraction to me. You know, just the ability to incorporate the D&H into my layout was a gigantic leap, because now I could run Alcos again and you could see U25Bs on a regular basis, you know? So mm-hmm. it was one of those things I didn't know a heck of a lot about, but kind of dove into head first once I realized that that's what I wanted to do with the addition when I built it, you know? And, sure. and, my friend Tony V gave us a really terrific tour down there, starting with DuPont. As soon as I saw DuPont, you know, the die was cast. What? When did you start your layout? I mean, did you now you moved out of the area to where you are now? I assume.
Yes, I've been in Georgia for 30 years now.
Okay.
Yeah, so I've, you know, but I still have family up there, and I came back at least once a year, you know, when my grandmother was still living, to, you know, spend time with her. I don't get back up to the Scranton area as much as I used to. But, you know, I still have a lot of family up there that, you know, that still lives in the area. And a lot of my family has deep roots in the coal mining industry up there. Both my father and my grandfather were heavy equipment operators in the strip mines around Carbondale. Mm-hmm. You know, during the 70s, you know, there was a big mine fire in Carbondale that they had to dig out and basically obliterate one side of the entire town because it was burning underneath the houses that were there.
Not that uncommon in Pennsylvania, was it?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, I mean, even to this day, there's still mine fires burning up there.
Exactly, that have been burning for years and years and years, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yep. Jeez. So. How soon after you moved down there did you decide you wanted to build the layout and start building it?
Well, actually, when I built the layout, and I actually modeled the Chessie system, you know, Appalachian coal haulers, soft coal haulers. And I had a layout for a while, you know, in middle school, high school. Going to college, I pretty much sold everything for, you know, beer money, because that's kind of what you do.
Sure.
And, yeah, so I kind of took a hiatus from the hobby for probably about 15 years or so.
I bet that's more common than not.
Yeah, I think it is. And in retrospect, taking the hiatus is one thing, but I just wish I didn't sell off all the equipment that I have. Because even to this day, if I'm looking at something on Facebook or something someone posts, I'm like, I had that structure, or geez, I had a pile of blue box Atherins that were, waist high, but it's all gone now. But so I probably wish I held on to a lot of my stuff, even if I wasn't
Even if it's just for
actively in the hobby.
sentimental reasons, right? I mean,
Exactly, yeah.
I have very little from my from the teen era because, let's face it, when I started model railroading, we were talking brass fiber tie flex track era. That was way back. And the only thing I kept really were a couple of kit bashes that I did that made it into my first published article in an old magazine called Railroad Modeler. I'm sure you haven't heard of it. But that's kind of why I hung on to those pieces, and I still have them in a drawer someplace. They're incredibly crude, but there's just like a sentimental attachment to them. So you modeled the chassis when you were in Pennsylvania, and then you moved
I
to
did, yeah.
Georgia, and you start modeling with Pennsylvania. That makes sense,
Yeah,
actually.
it doesn't make any sense at all, but not much that I do does. But yeah, I you know, so a after I got out of college, got married, bought our first house, didn't have a basement, really didn't have a area to do any modeling in. We then sold that house and moved, bought our house, built our house that we currently live in, and I had an entire unfinished basement, but again, was not involved in the hobby at that point. Had I been involved in that point, the pin division that exists today would probably be a lot more grandiose. But I finished off the basement. I put in a bar, a pool table, a living room, and I had two extra rooms that were unfinished. And I don't know why, but just one day I told my wife, I said, I think I'm going to build another small model railroad. It was just
Famous
a
last
fun,
words.
exactly. It was just a fun hobby, nothing too elaborate. I had like a, it was about a 10 by 12 room. I said, just something where I could go down there and tinker, no big deal. Okay, fine. Well, that was about 7 years ago, and that has morphed into what I have today. About 3 years ago, I ripped that completely down and started over.
Layout kaboom.
Yeah, exact, big time. Yeah. That, which it also involved framing out part of that living room that I had built. I basically cut that in half to gain more real estate. So lives the new version of it,
The
which.
parallels are almost uncanny because when I built this house originally, I had half the basement for the layout, which was probably, I don't know, let's just say 500-600 square feet, something like that. And the other half of it was my office. And then I outgrew that and built a building next door, moved my office into it. So then I put a pool table into what used to be my office. Sound familiar?
Yep.
And my buddies and my son and I used to shoot pool down there. And I quickly outgrew the layout room. And you know how it works. You just can't start looking for more space, And that's when I ended up moving water treatment equipment and air conditioning equipment and just everything that was remotely in the way. So, your story is, I think, a very familiar one to a lot of people. How many square feet do you have devoted to the layout now, do you think?
The current room is, well, it's the original 10 by 12 room, and then I've got another 12 by about 20 that I added through additional framing and stuff, basically right next door to it, and just busted out a doorway between the two rooms. So I've got a total of about 12 by 30
So it's almost like
right
two
now.
disconnected layout sections visually.
Visually, yes. I use that because it's basically like a third is, a third of the layout's in the small room and two-thirds of it's in the bigger room. And I use that dividing wall basically to transition from in one section Simpson into going north out of Carbondale, Simpson into Thompson, Pennsylvania. And then I utilize the other side coming out of South Scranton to transition into like the Green Ridge area. So I use that wall to my advantage to kind of separate the scene a little bit.
I got you. How far south do you go?
So my south staging yard is what I consider Hudson. So like the Hudson yard.
Oh yeah.
So that's the, like the south end of my railroad. Now my staging level's on scenic. But then from there it would come up, come into South Scranton, basically right there where the DL shops are currently, not the brand new ones, but the old.
Yeah. Is that the first scenic portion?
Yes, that's the first scenic portion of the layout.
Right. So you haven't modeled, you know, Manuka Junction or anything like that?
No,
I
haven't
done
anything further south.
Sounds like we could take your layout and put it immediately adjacent to a big section of mine.
Yeah, we'll just smush them right together and it would be one continuous.
Be a little bit of a commute, that's all. So I know the DLW shops and all of that. Is that the first part that you built?
Yes. So that's the first scenic section that I built. It was really the Thompson section. And I have my good friend Stephen Lamora gave me an exact replica of the Thompson station. That was built by James Brooks, and it's a beautiful model. He gave that to me for this version of the Penn Division. So that kind of spurred that whole scene I wanted to start on that first, that station to be the focal point there. And it's funny, that station still exists today. It, last I knew, it was an ice cream shop right there along the line, the former line.
There's so many repurposed buildings like that, especially in Pennsylvania, really seems like they really hated to knock these things down wholesale like they did maybe elsewhere in other areas. So the northernmost part, where is Northern Staging representing? Is that
the Northern Staging I call Oneonta.
Okay.
So that would be, you know, after you crossed in the New York state line, you would hit Nineveh Junction, basically, where it joined the Susquehanna Division, and then, you know, continue north to Oneonta. So that would be the northernmost part.
Okay. Then onward from that, you'd end up in Binghamton, I guess, right?
Right, yep. Mm-hmm.
Gotcha, okay. Now, you've only been building this thing for less than 7 years?
Actually, no. This version, I started in 2017. So I tore the old one down.
And they say I work like a maniac.
See, a lot, and it's funny because, you know, my wife would tease me because I gave in to peer pressure, but I joined a local round robin group, and there's, you know, seven or eight of us that, you know, prior to COVID, we would get together every Friday at someone else's house. And
sure.
You know, it's, you know, dealer's choice, whatever they wanted to do, if they wanted to run trains or work on whatever. So that quickly made my old layout look even smaller.
Yep.
Trying to give people jobs out on the patio and, you know, over here and over there, because obviously we can't all get in there.
Sure.
So I think one of the first nights that they were here at my layout, they started pulling tape measures around my basement. And I was like, whoa, 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 whoa. I was like, yeah, my wife let me join you guys on Fridays, but I said, you know, this could get ugly real fast if we're, you know, oh, no, you could bust out here, do this. Well, it, you know, again, here we are 3 years later, and I did exactly that. But
I know that feeling. I can remember the first time I had similar situation, you know, guys like Neil Schofield and Mike Confalone and Jim Dufour. These are all familiar names, I think, on the podcast. But they would come down, and first thing they would say is, this pool table's got to go, dude. You know, and I'm thinking, yeah, right. If only I could have seen a little farther forward into the future. But see, when you get into a kind of a peer group like that, and you start seeing some of these other really nice layouts, and in many cases, they're either pushing the envelope in terms of your own skill set, or certainly in terms of degree of completion or scope of the layout. And you start seeing what's possible, what it's like to run on a really nice railroad. And plus, I was using a lot of older techniques, you know, and I can tell based on what I see on your layout and how fast you've done it, that you're not using stodgy techniques. You're using modern techniques and modern materials. And we're going to talk about that a little bit, but, it's amazing how that just kind of gets the juice percolating, you know, and the next thing you know, you're plotting the next expansion. I tell myself this has got to be the last expansion because, you know, the older you get, I mean, I just turned 64. So I look at things a little differently now than I did when I was, say, you know, 50. You know, it's just a different scenario. How, may I ask how old you are?
I'm 41.
41. So you've got a lot of time ahead of you.
I do. Yeah. I've already been eyeballing it, Mike, but you know, my wife will probably wind up hearing this at some point. So we won't talk too much about that, but yeah, I mean, there's some things that I've thought about as far as I put the switch in on my current layout for the Vine Street branch.
Planning ahead.
It goes to the wall. And there's a nice area in the hallway outside of that would be a cool little shelf situation where I could do, you know, just a dead end, but you know, you're all the industries that are on the Vine Street branch, and that would be a crew's job at night would be to run the Vine Street branch and, you know, go out to the other room and work all the industries and then come back to Green Ridge Yard. So there's been plans talked about with that with my operating guys. So we'll see if we go forward with that in the future, but.
Well, we can keep that between you and I and a few thousand listeners here. So the design of the layout, was it something that you had kind of had in your head for a long time? Did it grow organically as space presented itself? Did you draw up the whole thing prior to even doing the first thing? Like talk about that a little bit.
It was really... There was some planning involved in it. One of the members of my group is real good with Third Planet, I believe, is the software that he uses. Yeah. So I kind of, you know, threw some generals, you know, and it was real napkin type crude drawings that I tossed at him.
Sure.
He, you know, kind of put it in there and figured out, you know, what would fit into the space, what I could do with the space. What the biggest thing that I wanted in this version versus the older version was staging.
Right.
I had zero staging in the old layout. Now,
if you don't have staging, you're not going to operate over the long run and be satisfied with it.
Absolutely not. No. And that I learned that real, but again, when I built the first version of it, like I said, you know, well, I just want it for me just to go down there, run some trains around in a circle.
You didn't know what you didn't know.
Exactly. I mean, that quickly evolved into, you know, okay, this looks like the bridge in Landsboro. I think I'll model this whole area, the Starucka area right here. And well, that looks good. Well, maybe I can make this look like this. So before you knew it, I built a helix in the opposite room, kind of like where my the bigger portion of the room is currently, and built a second level in the small room. So I had a double deck layout in there so that I could get a little more mileage in between scenes. But again, the footprint of the layout was still small, and it was hard to maneuver with two, even two guys was getting tight. Three was, yeah, you're bumping bellies at that point then.
So that's the layout that you tore out basically and started from scratch on. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. There's something very clarifying about that, isn't there?
It was one of those things that, you know, I thought about it and I'm like, you know, I'm happy with what I have. I was pleased with the way things looked. Now, there were a lot of things that I would have done differently. There's a lot of new techniques that I've learned,
right?
But that's a tough pill to swallow to think about. Well, I'm going to rip all this down and just start over. Where
you just watch the man hours go right into the dumpster.
Yeah,
you know?
And then you
but
think
the way I rationalized it is, okay, I'm a process guy. I like to enjoy the process of doing this. So all of that fun that I had doing it, can't take that away. I had it. It's in the fun bank, you know?
Yeah.
And when I tear something apart, mentally for me, the best way for me to do it is to salvage as much as I can from it. Mm-hmm. So I don't go in there with a chainsaw and cut it into sections and throw it out in the driveway. I'm trying to reuse things that have ongoing value. You know what I mean?
Right.
What style are you? Are you a slash and burn, or are you a salvage it and move on?
This was pretty much slash and burn. Yeah. I mean, I salvaged some of the lumber. It was a double track helix, so I was able to salvage a lot of the Code 100 track that was in that helix out of there, which made up most of my staging yard. I only had to buy, maybe 10 sticks of Code 100 to finish my staging yards.
Yards just gobble track,
yes,
don't they?
Yes, they do. Yep.
Go ahead.
I didn't do. A lot of people ask me about that when they see my staging yards. They're like, "Well, why don't you put your tracks closer together?" But yeah, and I guess hindsight, maybe I should have. I could have had a couple extra staging yard tracks. But I've got five on each side, and I wanted to be able to reach in there if there were particular cars that I wanted without knocking everything over and having a domino effect in there. So
yeah, and if you had to manually re-rail something or whatever, I mean, things happen. Trust me, you want at least finger room between tracks. But I was going to say, I went from one big double-ended staging yard to now I have 1, 2, 3, 4 of them. And they're all 16 to 22 feet long. So, and one of them is 8 tracks. So you can imagine how much flex track goes into this just staging, box after box. Absolutely. What are you using for track, by the way?
So all of the staging and then the ramp tracks that that lead up to the layout level are just Atlas Code 100. On the main line, once it gets back into the visible trackage, I'm using Atlas Code 83 on the main lines, and then I'm using Micro Engineering 70 on all of the yards and industry spurs and stuff like that.
What about turnouts?
Turnouts are all Walters 83, and then all Shinohara 70s.
So are all of your turnouts powered?
Yes, all Tortoise powered.
Yeah. Yeah, you got some infrastructure there. The I was just looking at a couple of pictures of your layout, and I'll post a couple of these in a link to your group on the podcast group after we post the podcast. I find your photos to be absolutely authentic looking. The track looks great. The ballast looks just right. The black ground cover, the culm piles and what have you. I'm going to be picking your brain about that shortly. Even the underbrush and the foliage and the weathering on the on the locomotives and rolling stock, it's all just right.
And that's one of the things I think that probably makes it believable. And you wouldn't, I mean, normally if you're going to paint your plaster shell, model railroading 101 is you get a brown or a beige color paint and slop it all over, right? Because that's what color dirt is. But that northern anthracite field, even if it's not in the coal mine, it's all that real dark shale,
just
a real black color. And it just wouldn't look right otherwise if you didn't have that black undertone over the top of everything. So, I mean, that's the first thing I do with plain plywood is just apply a flat black paint to it and just kind of dull it all down and get that shaley black look to it.
Well, so hang on. So you're actually scenicing right on bare plywood in some cases?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I love it. So I'm looking at a picture right now. It's your most recent picture, crossing the Lackawanna River on the way north to Carbondale. So it's got the bridge on the right-hand side, and it's got like this wooded hillside sort of embankment behind the locomotive, and a really good looking culm pile in the right foreground. Mm-hmm. What are you making your wooded hillsides out of?
So what you're looking at in that picture, where the track is and where that spur track comes into the bumper, that's all right on top of the plywood.
Okay.
Now the hill directly behind the locomotive there is foam. That's all extruded foam, stacked up, carved, shaped. And then I usually cover the top of the foam with plaster cloth you know, to give me that hard shell base, and then I paint that black from there.
So you, all your scenery base is starting with a flat black. Interesting, even if it's a treed wooded area.
Absolutely. Yep.
Huh.
Because, and it also helps with, you know, it gives you those little shadows and those little pockets of darkness looking into those trees. And I think it just adds a little bit of depth into the super trees as well, having that black underneath there versus anything else.
You know, I, this last area that I built before I started on this locomotive building binge that I'm trying to complete here, was that area around Avoca Yard. I don't know if you remember seeing any of the pictures that I posted on that, but that was the first area on the layout that I started using some of those really, really, you know, dark ground cover techniques. And immediately I thought, well, okay, that's what that area looks like, you know. Yeah. So your culm pile, now what are you using for that? That looks really good.
Well, again, that's just, you know, I just take small cubes of foam, stack them up, shape them with the, you know, once everything is dry, I'll shape them with a knife and get that kind of cylindrical cone shaped look to it. Cover them with the plaster cloth again, paint them flat black. The biggest thing that I use for my ground cover is black tile grout. You could just you could buy it in any home center, and you can get a box that would probably do yours, mine, Neil's, and Mike Confalone's layout together with one box, you know.
No, when I when Mike came over one time to do the he was going to show me his technique for doing the like dirt parking lots and what have you, you know, which I always admired how he did it on his layout. So he had me pick up, you know, not a minuscule amount, but you know, like a good, like a 10-pound container of each, you know, and he mixed it all up. And like, it's just exactly like you said, I've got enough to do five different layouts now, but it's not that expensive.
It makes a great base because it kind of gives it that, it's not shiny at all. It kind of gives it that dusty, dirty look. It's almost like a weathered parking lot right out of the box.
Exactly. So when I look at your siding here, for example, that's just basically black grout on there.
Yeah, I basically just buried the track in that black grout. Yep.
And did you wet it and bond it, or is it loose?
I soak it down really, really good with a water alcohol dilution.
Yeah.
And the, you know, just the natural properties of the grout are going to be to solidify when it's wet. And it,
so you skip the glue entirely.
Exactly. Yeah. The only thing I'm gluing is, you know, the textures that you would see on top of it, whether it be, you know, the loose coal or, you know, whatever that's glued on top of that.
So everything I see in the picture is basically bonded.
Yep.
And the culm pile, just to get back to that, you know, you've got some larger pieces of aggregate. I mean, is that real coal that you're using, or real shale?
That's actually a Scenic Express product. It's called Mine Run Coal.
Okay.
And it's varying textures, varying sizes of coal. And I don't know if it's actual coal or what, but it looks very convincingly like coal. And it'll have big chunks all the way down to like a almost a powdery texture.
Sure, and that's your final technique there.
Yep, and it's all mixed in one box. So if you grab a scoop of it with a spoon and sift it out, you're going to get some of that fine stuff mixed in with some medium size with a couple of big chunks in there, and that's what a lot of those piles, because they were just mining coal as fast as they could. So there, it wasn't like today's, you know, process where nothing is wasted. There was just piles of stuff everywhere, and you know, you worry about sizing and stuff like that later. But the idea was to just get it out of the ground. And that's kind of what I was trying to go for there.
Yeah, well, I think that's what, I think more than anything in your techniques, it's the use of these different sizes of material in the right proportions that just makes it look like it looks, you know. And that, I think that's what leapt out to me. What are you using for your mainline track ballast?
That's Scenic Express as well. That's like a blended,
it's a real rock ballast.
Yeah. Real rock ballast, but it's blended, you know, like it's got grays and a little bit of blacks in it too. So,
yep. Now when it comes down to locomotives, how big a fleet do you have?
I probably have between 30 and 40. It's not a huge fleet. I've got,
it's a good amount though.
Yeah, it's a good amount, you know, and I usually have anywhere from usually 3 to 4 locomotives on a train. The grade coming out of my staging up to the layout level is about 3%. So it's a pretty stiff grade. And that was probably the biggest challenge, kind of getting back to the design aspect, was to figure out how to do this without putting a helix in. It's going to eat up a ton of space.
Right.
But get, with the space I have, to get a ramp that's not, you know, 4%, 4.5%.
So how long a grade is that?
It's about 40, 43 feet on both sides.
So it peaks in the middle?
It peaks basically right behind the scene with the Starucca bridge.
So let me understand. So you've got 43 feet of 3% grade. What's the elevation we're talking about here?
About 15 inches.
Okay, that's why you need so much. Yeah, because usually I'm not separating by nearly that amount, and even then I've got some long runs at 2%. You know. Mm-hmm. So, what's a typical train length?
Typical train length is probably 14 cars or so.
Okay.
But it will require all three of those locomotives to get it out of staging up to the layout level.
Oh, I believe it.
Which you know, a lot of the guys, some of the guys in my group were like, well, you know, that's going to be too steep. I said, that's the way it was done on the Penn Division, you know, regardless. I said, you know, there was no, you know, two locomotives going up to the top of ARAP Mountain. That just wasn't going to get it. So
that's right.
I'm okay with having, you know, yeah, 3% grade is, it's probably a lot steeper than most modelers would like to have. But, you know, I'm okay with the way it operates because it's prototypical, really.
Well, the 3% is not in the scenic area, or is some?
No, it is not. No,
okay.
So behind each staging yard. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I mean, once that track gets up to the layout level, it's, you know, when it comes out from behind that mountain, it's basically a level track at that point. So you really don't see any of it to have to hide it with scenery.
Have you ever been tempted to try helpers?
I have done that. Yes. Yep. And not by wanting to, but more so needing to, you know, having a train come out of here, and I would get it about halfway up and it's just sitting there spinning, and I'm trying to reach behind boxes and shelves to try to nudge it along. So I would just get another locomotive and run it up the line right behind it, just, you know, on the other side of my Digitrax throttle, and just push the whole thing up to the top and then uncouple it and run it back down. And I thought, wait a minute.
It's very prototypical. Cool. Well, you know, let's see. Are you running Loke Sound or Soundtracks? Like, what's your preference?
Loke Sound is I've got probably 90% of my locomotives have Loke Sound in them.
Yep. Yep. Are you doing the installs yourself?
I am. I used to do them. It's something that I do not enjoy in the hobby. That's probably the one aspect that I do not enjoy as much, but you know, I have, you know, if it's a simple plug-in type deal, you know, yeah, I could handle that. But I've done a few of the, you know, the board replacements, and it's just something that I don't know. I dread it, and I don't want to have to do anything that I dread in the hobby.
You know? So, you really have to do a lot of it to get good at it. You know, and honestly, my experience has been, you don't get. I mean, anybody can do an install, right? But to do them well, inefficiently, you got to get a couple hundred under your belt, really. Sure, you know what I mean? Sure. To be exposed to all the different issues that you can run into, different, you know, with different brands and different eras of different brands, you know, because working on a modern Atlas is very different from working on a, you know, like a classic series Atlas, you know. Your locos look great. Are you doing the painting and weathering yourself?
Yes, the painting and weathering I've done myself. Most of the paint is factory. There are probably, I would say maybe a half dozen or so that I've done myself. I did the Bicentennial RS3M. I painted that one myself.
Well, so who built the RS3M? Did you kitbash it yourself?
I did. I kitbashed two of them, and then I've got two or three more that are – and the name is going to escape me right now, but it's a resin shell that's available commercially.
Yeah, I've actually worked on several of those for one of my customers. I found that I had to do some reassembly.
Yeah, they're not accurate. I mean, if you're going to really start counting rivets, but you know, I mean, for a stand-in model until, I guess, hopefully one day Bowser comes out with theirs. Yeah, I mean, they're decent.
Right. I think I could justify having one of them. I don't know. I think I can wait. You know what I mean? I don't know. It's not so important that I want to go to the mat with it, you know?
Right.
And like in your era, there's no C424Ms, right?
No, they hadn't come along really yet. They were, that's more, you know, a little bit more early 80s.
Right. So those are important locos for my era. Mm-hmm. So, I've been working on a couple of those, and they're fairly far along. One thing that's kind of been holding things up is I'm working on getting in some important upgrade parts for those. That's really all I can say about it right now, but it involves going to another continent to get them. Mm-hmm. Something that used to be readily available and isn't. So,
right.
I'm working on that, and I think if I'm able to make that deal and get them in, then that's like the last thing holding up continued progress on those locos. Meanwhile, you know, the shells are painted and decorated and all that. They're really just waiting for final assembly. And I just actually masked and did my first lightning stripe paint scheme. I had never done one of those before, and I had always thought, oh boy, if I can't get a factory painted lightning stripe, I don't think I want to do it. But I said, you know, but a buddy of mine, Bob Harp, who used to do a lot of my custom painting, he kind of retired from it recently. So I thought, you know what, I'm going to go for it. And I, to my surprise, I found that I actually enjoyed the challenge of the complicated masking and what have you. And in fact, I just put the last coat of blue on the nose of a 410 this afternoon. So next it's decals.
There you go. Bring it to life.
So what kind of traffic do you have on your railroad?
So when we have an operating session, we mainly run road freights out of either south or north staging that'll run across the line. And it's, I have a paper train, that, you know, it's mainly paper coming out of Canada.
Oh, sure.
But there's a lot of, you know, just mixed freight.
Now, does that basically run through, or do you drop some cars from it?
It runs through. Sometimes we'll drop cars because there was a lot of business in downtown Scranton for paper. I know the Times Tribune, you know, they all had a dock that they received paper off of. I think it was like a public dock. It wasn't actually at the facility itself, but they dropped off paper. And there was some traffic that was serviced out of Green Ridge Yard. But for the most part, my paper train just runs straight through. That's a through freight. But then a lot of the industries that I model, specifically like Hendrix Manufacturing, that's the metal perforating plant in Carbondale. In the late 70s, man, you'd be lucky if you saw a car spotted in their spur. It just wasn't, they were really moving more towards truck traffic at that point. I took a little modeler's license on that, and you know, I've got, you know, coil cars that will spot there, or flat cars with you know, sheet steel that will spot there. My Carbondale Ready Mix, you know, we'll run sand into that.
So hang on one sec, because I'll forget to ask you later. Did you say metal perforating?
Yeah, and actually the business is still in Carbondale. It's not in the original location, and it's not any longer rail served, but it was a industry, you know, basically servicing the mines. They would perforate metal and make different size screens for the breakers.
Okay.
So once all that mining industry went away, they kind of moved their business more towards like decorative and architectural stuff versus, you know, screens for mining. But the company still does exist. It's still in Carbondale today.
Right. It's probably a smaller business, and probably even back in the day, it was more raw materials in than finished goods out by rail, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And they're actually, believe it or not, there were actually two, and still are today, there are two metal perforating companies in Carbondale. So, yeah, it seems like an obscure industry, but there are actually two of them in Carbondale.
It's literally the first time I've actually heard of that particular industry. Yeah. So I'm looking at the picture of you switching out the produce warehouse in South Scranton. You know, the whole scene looks good. Is the brick building to the left of the warehouse a photo?
Yes, it's a photo backdrop. It was a commercially available one that I had gotten a long time ago. I don't even remember the manufacturer of it, but I just mounted it onto a piece of foam core board to just kind of give it a little bit of depth off the backdrop.
It looks great, though, really. I mean, you know, you've obviously got an eye for how something is supposed to look, and that's kind of like, you know, job one to be able to bring it about.
Right.
How about rolling stock?
Rolling stock.
Do you have anything that's unique to your modeled area?
The only thing that I have, not so much unique to the area, but I have the ilmenite cars, the yellow hopper cars on the D&H. I have a set of four of those that I did.
I know enough about this ilmenite operation to be dangerous. So if you know more about it, I've got a few questions.
Know more than I do.
Well, I saw one and photographed the heck out of it. I forget where it was. You know, I mean, I've been poking around in Pennsylvania so long. It's all a blur, but I remember seeing the little placard on the side that said ilmenite loading only. And I think I understand that it came from a mine somewhere, I think in New York.
Yeah, it was a northern end of the system industry. But I think they used it for the processing of, I want to say titanium maybe.
Okay.
So, I mean, it traveled the system to get to, you know, I don't know if they brought it down to Bethlehem or you know, steel producing areas of the country, but I believe it was something, there was something in the makeup of that they used in smolting of titanium, I believe it was.
Okay. So it's basically an ingredient.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Huh. You also have done something that I haven't seen modeled before, and that's the vines crawling up the poles.
Yes.
That must have been fun to do.
It was fun. And that just came to me like, you know, it was funny. My wife's aunt had given my son a little HO scale, you know, round the Christmas tree type little cheap train set. And he plays with it. And, you know, I set it up for him and I'd run it. He's more interested in just taking the cards and bashing them together. So I said, yeah, you know what? Have at it, guy. You know, just that's yours. You do what you want with it. But there was a bag, a Ziploc bag of about 20 of those telephone poles. And I got to looking at them, and I'm like, with a little bit of paint and tender love and care, I can actually make this look like something. So I brought them downstairs and threw them on the workbench. And one night I said, you know what, I'm going to tinker with these. And I started roughing them up with my Dremel tool and just, you know, painted the insulators and gave them a little black wash. And so that's relatively believable. So then I start planting them on the layout. And, well, yeah, that's how I remember them, all crooked and falling over, and there wasn't a one of them that was straight. And then, you know, all that kind of spurred, yeah, you know what, I remember some of them just being draped in these vines that, you know, were growing up all over them because nobody's touched them in 40, 50 years probably. So I just started experimenting with a couple of different techniques and came up with that, you know, with using that twine and interlaced it around one of them. I said, well, yeah, that looks pretty good for now until I can come up with something better. So that's kind of how all that came about.
And just to continue on with the technique involved, what's the bonding agent? And you're using Scenic Express leaves, right?
Yeah, the super leaf. And then I took some twine, and you know how twine is kind of raveled together.
Sure.
I unraveled it to get, you know, not make it as bulky, to get it a little bit thinner. So I took, you know, maybe two or three strands of it, kind of twisted them back together, and I laid them out on a piece of plywood, and I just sprayed them with spray adhesive and just dusted them with the super leaf and just kind of rolled them around in the super leaf a little bit until I had a, because I didn't want it to be completely covered with leaves. I wanted you to be able to see a little bit of that viney, brown viney structure underneath it.
Right.
So I'd knock a little bit of the excess off, and that's, it's just kind of a trial and error type thing.
I'm looking at your scene here. It says the local continuing north through Starucca. And obviously this isn't Starucca Viaduct. I'm looking at the microengineering trestles there. I've never seen that on the prototype. So that exists in that spot on the prototype?
It does. Well, it did. But it's actually in Starucca, Pennsylvania.
Okay.
And the D&H named that bridge, or nicknamed it, Little Starucca.
Okay.
So it was a metal bridge that crossed over Buck Creek. It was a few miles south of the actual Starucca Viaduct. That was there. I mean, I think the footings are still there along the rail trail, and I think they recently made a nice like a switchback up and down both sides of the valley that bridge went over on the rail trail now. So you can kind of, walk around the footings, and they have a nice plaque there, with pictures of it and everything. So
it's a really nice looking scene. What are you using for your weathering?
So the bridge is a combination of microengineering and the newer Walters kits.
Sure.
I kit bash those together just to get a little bit more length. Because I had that scene on the old version of the layout. It was obviously a little bit shorter, a little bit more compressed. I wanted to stretch it out a little bit on this one. So I used, because I didn't want to battle with that microengineering kit for another month and a half, I switched to the Walters ones and just kind of filled in a little bit. The bridge was built, set in place. It's just a flat black spray paint. And then I just kind of highlighted some of the rivet lines and stuff with some rust powders on the bridge itself.
How about on the abutment? Are you using oils or pan pastels?
A little bit of everything. So that's a Mark Roach technique that we got to talking one day, and he graciously explained how to make a piece of plastic look like old concrete like that. And that's just taking a Dremel tool, just giving it some texture versus just that, flat, shiny plastic. Take the tip of that tool and just kind of gouge it in there every once in a while to make those chips that you would see in aged concrete abutments. And, black washes on there. And then, the oil spots or the rust spots themselves are oil paints. But, yeah, it's a combination of pan pastels and black washes and oil paints.
Yeah, that's just a good looking scene. You look at that scene, it's probably a great place to photograph your trains on. Speaking of photography, are you doing anything fancy for your photographs?
No, just cell phones. Yeah, I mean, okay. just pop a picture with a cell phone, and I'll go in there. And Bob Fallfield yelled at me a few weeks ago about orientation of the picture to make my perspective, and I was like, okay. So he gave me a few pointers on orienting the pictures and stuff afterwards, and I might adjust the color a little bit here and there, but for the most part it's just snapping pictures with cell phone.
Yeah, meanwhile we've got Ron Papierkiewicz there doing focus stacking of six different focus points. So it goes to show you, there's more than one way to accomplish a goal here.
With a 2.5-year-old, I don't have time to photo stack. So.
Oh, you're busy chasing him.
What you see on my site is he'll want to come down here, 2-3 times a week at night before he goes to bed. We'll fire up a train, running around the layout. I'll snap 6 or 8 pictures and then bowl them out over the course of the next week. So
that's
pretty much what you're seeing out of here.
No, that's very efficient. So when you guys operate, I wanted to kind of finish up with some questions about this. How are you handling, how are you orchestrating your operations? Do you have a card system of some kind, or?
I've been creating, and that's still kind of in its infancy right now with operation on this layout. I've done some, basic switch lists, and I've just created them in an Excel format, and I'll just take car numbers that are in the yards, because I use both yards, either Carbondale or Greenridge, as basically set out and pickup yards. So the road freights that are going to stop and work those yards will drop off a set of cars that's on my switch list that needs to be left and pick up a set that's waiting to be picked up, and then continue on to the staging from there. And then we also have local crews that, you know, we call them the P jobs, because that was the local switchers that ran out of, at this time, Greenridge, that would then take the cars from the yard and distribute them out to the industries around the layout. So we'll usually have a crew that'll run the local jobs like that, switch the industries, and then we'll have other crews that are taking freights out of staging and running them to layout, whether it's a through freight or stopping and working the yards, they'll do that. But I'm still in the process of developing my switch list. It's very primitive right now, but we've probably had about 3 good operating sessions before COVID hit on this layout, where we were actually here running trains, trying to develop a system to do exactly what you're talking about.
Sure.
So that kind of got interrupted. But prior to that, the guys in my group, and that's one of the reasons I went ahead and pulled the trigger and tore the old layout down, is the guys that are in my operating group they're a fantastic bunch of modelers, and each one has their own strength that they're really good at. And I learned so much from them just being in the group that I had to have a blank canvas to try all this new stuff out on. So that's the main reason why I did it. And then when I tore my layout down, we spent like 5 or 6 Fridays in a row at my house specifically. They came here every week, and we knocked out a lot of the heavy two-man type stuff, the bench work,
sure,
cutting plywood, doing all that kind of stuff. Get me with a good sub road bed where I could start coming down here and just laying track at night by myself or whatever. So they were instrumental on the development and execution of this layout. And like I said, we were finally starting to work out some operating plans when COVID hit. Now we haven't met since back in the beginning of March now. So
I know what that's like.
Yeah.
You're going to find probably that, I guess I would encourage you not to commit too heavily to a scheme for managing your operations too early, because you're going to find that your thoughts on it will almost definitely evolve as you run the layout. And then you're going to find that you're going to have issues or problems or just things that you need to do. And the need will drive these methodologies that will enable you to, create, kind of your own way of operating your layout. And it's going to evolve over time. So, absolutely. Go into it at a shallow angle would be my advice. How long does it take you to set up for an op session with your streets and all that?
It's really interesting. It's kind of hard to describe with the way my staging yards are set up, but they're mirror images of each other underneath the layout. And they're connected via a swing out bridge that, you have to duck under to come in underneath the scenic level of my layout. But then the staging levels are connected with the swing out bridge under that same duck under. So when a train comes out of south, traverses the entire layout and ends up in north and vice versa, at the end of an operating session, in order to restage the layout, I simply just have to back the trains up into their opposing yards again versus having to physically handle any of the trains.
Yep.
So I could restage this railroad in 15, 20 minutes on a Saturday morning after we have an op session.
So by definition, then, you're not removing cars from staging and putting them in boxes and taking new ones out.
No, I don't. Right. I don't have a fleet big enough that I just basically everything I own is on this layout somewhere.
Yeah. Do you think? Can you envision just continuing to accumulate more rolling stock like we all do, and eventually having
of course.
To? Yeah. Yeah. Yep. And that's one of the things I like about modeling the D&H is you were talking about power on trains. I mean, I could throw four or five or six engines on a train and it looks fine.
Right.
I still want to try
every one of them a different paint scheme too.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I love the mix of the different schemes. I do at some point, you know, on my laundry list, I want to try some helpers, because when I'm coming up out of my staging to get, you know, to head south into Taylor, that's a steady 2% grade, but it's also like a big, gentle, sweeping S curve. Mm-hmm. And I think that the train could benefit from a little hind end assistance there, as long as we can do it judiciously, you know. And it's hard to experiment with it and not, because you want to learn some lessons, but you'd rather not dump anything while you're learning these lessons, yeah, you know. So the fact that it's a big, gentle, sweeping S curve kind of exacerbates the problem a little bit, you know.
Yeah, but and I've done it both ways. I've used locomotives that were consistent with the lead locomotives. I haven't, knock on wood, I haven't dumped anything yet. I've also done it where, like during an op session where I had a person actually was our pusher engineer.
Sure.
And, you know, he had control of those locomotives. And what I did is I just pinned the KD coupler open on the front of the locomotive. That way we didn't have to use uncoupling tools. We could uncouple on the fly.
Oh, okay.
And, he would push them up and then run back down the staging, and whichever next one was coming up, you'd push that one up the opposite way. And it actually turned out to be a fun job, you know, during the operating session. So that, you know, that could add a little, you know, another dimension to the operating sessions as well.
Probably a good job for somebody who's a good operator, because you've got to have a good feel for the throttle in order to do that right. I've done a little bit of that on other layouts and frankly enjoyed it. You know, it's like a nice team effort.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like running a real train. You have to, you know, watch the couplers, make sure that, you know, you're not putting too much pressure on the train, or, you know, you're not dragging the locomotive. So,
well, yeah, even the prototype has problems with that sometimes, as we've seen lately. Yep. They keep dumping empty auto racks on Horseshoe Curve, you know?
Right.
Well, Justin, thanks for being a guest on the show here. I mean, I think that, you know, you're just another one of those guys who's actually doing it. And those are the people I like to talk to and share techniques with. So, the name of Justin's group is the D&H Pen Division in HO Scale, and he's got a nice Facebook group for that. I'll put a link to the group on Crew Call. And Justin, if there are any photos you'd like to share on Crew Call, please feel free.
I certainly will. Yeah.
My plans moving forward here are to finish up this locomotive building binge. I've got what do I have? I've got 10 days or so left in the month. That'll be completing 4 months of a anticipated 1 month project. But, you know, once you get into a serious locomotive building binge, do you really want to put all the parts away and everything that you need to do it, or you just want to march through it, you know?
Yeah, push through.
But now I look at the calendar and I look at the weather and I think, you know, the month of October is the month to be outside spraying Super Tree armatures for the winter. So I think I know what I'm doing in October. And then once I get into the winter, I've got some layout building projects like the, you know, like Jimmy Simmons ran some paper mill that he made for me. And I've got Rich Cobb making some houses for the little village there around the entrance to Taylor Yard. So that'll be another scene that once those are here, you know, it'll kind of build itself. So I think that, you know, it looks like we're going to be doing what we're doing for the foreseeable future here. So I'm going to lay in some supplies for a long, cold winter, I think.
Yeah, I agree.
All right, Justin, enjoy the conversation.
All right, thank you, Mike. It was a pleasure.
Take care. Okay.
All right.
Nice job. Fun. You're a pro.
I just like model railroading, so it's easy to talk about.
Exactly. Well, you know what? It's easy to talk to people who are actually doing something.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, if you're just talking about it, that's one thing. But, you know, my favorite people are the ones who are actually doing the modeling, you know, and I give you a lot of credit for doing what you did with a 2.5-year-old.
Yeah, well, A 2.5-year-old should not have that long of an attention span, but he absolutely loves to be down here with me.
You know what? That's marvelous, because yeah. That's something that you guys can bond over, and you know, if you're lucky, it'll carry you right through the teen years, right up until about when he gets his learner's permit.
Yeah, exactly. Butt trained.
That was my experience anyway. Justin, have a great night. I'll be posting this up later tonight.
Sounds good. Thanks, Mike.
Take care.
All right, take care.